Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host, Desiree McSwain, as well as the Project Censored senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips will return in 2 weeks. On today's program, which is recorded on Inauguration Day, we will cover the resistance to the Trump regime. In addition, we will also talk about issues of news abuse and junk food news concerning human trafficking and the California storms. Please stay with us.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, skies, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Desiree McSwain. We are guest hosting this week and next week. And we're also joined by our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. And we have a lot to get to today, but Desiree, how are things going?
As good as they can, I think, today. As good as they can.
Interesting day in our history. What about you, Michael? What's going on over there?
Just getting through.
Well, the sullen voices definitely have something to do with the inauguration of the Trump machine and the end of this age of Obama that we're now facing, so we'll definitely be getting to that today. And also just to kind of want to get to some headlines as well before we do, I also want to mention, I thought it was kind of an interesting piece I saw about Chelsea Manning. It's odd to me that Barack Obama, in my opinion, would be remembered for his war on whistleblowers. And yet at the end of his term, here he is releasing Chelsea Manning from prison. And Chelsea Manning became sort of this iconic symbol of Obama's war on whistleblowers in the United States. So I thought that was an interesting way to sort of start the program talking about this release of Chelsea Manning and the start of the Trump regime.
Yeah, I certainly think Obama put quite a coda on his presidency with that move. I think with everything happening around Trump's election, with Russia's support, with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange coming so strongly back into the news, Edward Snowden obviously hasn't ever left the news. Russia apparently just granted him several more years of a stay in Russia. But the fact that kind of the third figure in that trio of Assange and Snowden, Chelsea Manning, it's a pretty remarkable move to grant clemency to Chelsea at the end. And it says something about contrasting Obama's policy through his 8 years with this final exonerating.
It was like Barack Obama kind of like throwing this Hail Mary, doing everything he could to insulate the Trump regime from doing what they could. I wonder if he's also going to take his drones home with him when he leaves the White House as well. We'll get into more of that about the inauguration and this new regime that's taking over. But before we do that, we want to get to some of our headlines. Desiree.
Some of our headlines, and you can find these on projectcensored.org as well as gcml.org. First, I'm going to start with the judges across the U.S. using racially biased software in assessing defendants' risk of committing future crimes. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder warned that so-called risk scores might be injecting bias in the nation's judicial system. This is obviously nothing new, but it's becoming more and more of an issue. So courtrooms across the country use risk scores, also known as risk assessments, to rate a defendant's risk of future crime. As we know, most people who are targeted tend to be of color, usually men as well. Part of what we realized with the ProPublica study was that they were particularly likely to falsely flag these black defendants as future criminals, wrongly labeling them this way at almost twice the rate as white defendants. Again, nothing surprising. What is surprising is the fact that they put so much faith into these risk assessments when, according to some, it is nothing more than as accurate as a coin flip.
So they're using these racial demographics as a way to assess who is more likely to commit a crime. And what do you mean by this coin flip analogy?
All they really said was that's about as accurate as it is, as far as their level of expertise. So, yeah, pretty surprising, but then again, not. But part of also what they were saying is black defendants were still 77% more likely to be identified as higher risk for violent crimes and 45% more likely to be predicted to commit a future crime of any kind.
And remind us again, where did this study originally come from?
Originally from ProPublica. Student researchers and faculty over at Citrus College brought this to us.
this is the work the Project Censor does. You can get this at projectcensor.org. Students in the classroom work with faculty to find stories that the corporate press ignores and that the independent press covers. And Desiree, I think that was a great story to cover. Weren't you also telling me there was a documentary that recently covered some similar topics, right?
Yes. Documentary called Do Not Resist, directed by Craig Atkinson, which I saw multiple times. I also held a Food for Thought to discuss it within the community of Oakland. But there was a gentleman, I think his name is Richard Burke, and other individuals who delve even deeper into the serious bias behind all this technology and just going further into forecasting or potentially forecasting criminals, but just the language and everything surrounded. I think they had a line in there somewhere about how do you tell a mother that her son is 50-50 likely to commit a homicide and these things purely based off of this technologies.
So we've moved our racism into the digital age now. We've digitized racism.
Yes, we've, yeah, robotized it.
And you can bet under Trump that will be uber-robotized.
That's true. That power is now in the hands of the Trump regime as well and those who support him. Well, interesting story. Okay, and like you said, you can find that at projectcensored.org. What are some other headlines we have for us today, Desiree?
Another one. Young plaintiffs invoke constitutional grounds for climate protection in federal court. And this one was actually really interesting. 21 plaintiffs aged 18 to 19 brought a lawsuit against federal government and the fossil fuel industry of the U.S. It was ruled in favor of the plaintiff's charge that the federal government violates constitutional and public trust rights by its ongoing promotion of fossil fuels that destabilize the Earth's climate, which we all know. The court agreed to the plaintiff's assertion that it is the government's duty to abide by the rules of public trust doctrine, protecting essential natural resources. So, Collective of Youth, which is obviously really inspiring as well, stood up to the ongoing war waged against the planet, really.
This is another example here of news abuse, right? So we have these types of stories that are connected to the fossil fuel industry and climate change. And we just had these Senate confirmation hearings, right? I put confirmation in quotes. But none of these issues, these critical issues, are brought up, right? It's these young activists, people are going to have to live with this in the future, that are trying to bring up these issues. We're going to have to face the outcome of these. But you have an older establishment that's playing this Democrats versus Republican game in the confirmation hearings, not touching upon these matters that actually do matter to people in the U.S.
It really reflects the popular movement that is speaking on behalf of science and real truth and reality versus the government that Trump wants to bring in, which is a handful of extremely powerful people, all of whom either deny climate change is happening or that humans are responsible and that we should be working to fix it.
I just saw a study that said something like in the late 20th century or maybe since the 20th century, this is the whitest cabinet and least educated cabinet that we've had in U.S. history as entering office.
Certainly the richest.
Definitely the wealthiest as well.
Yeah, it was interesting too because they said three fossil fuel industry trade associates, they called the case a direct, quote, a direct substantial threat to our businesses.
Threat to our businesses,
yeah,
yes.
Not to the earth, not to the water or to the planet, but to our businesses, so.
I think you're going to see more stories like this. I think that the North Dakota, the Standing Rock protests, right, everything that is the climate movement that was Keystone, that are all the pipeline protest movements happening in the South, in Texas, in Florida now. This case is a really interesting test case. And this is the sort of model I think maybe they'll try to work with for indigenous rights, for people in communities, environmental racism and pollution.
This is what these individuals are up against too, though, right? The corporate media does adopt this narrative of like, well, we have to show the side that's good for business and we'll go down and interview the protesters as if both have like a legitimate argument. In corporate media, if they had any sort of backbone or spine, I think they would point out that your business isn't going to matter if the earth is not sustainable for human beings. That's really where to start these critical discussions.
I thought that was great, though, just to see the youth, how they stood up. And it's also something to say that that's really where the spotlight is, whether for good or for bad. But the youth are really leading all the movements today.
I would totally agree on that. I think that's one of the most inspiring things. You know, again, in media and entertainment, the narrative is sort of the youth are checked out and addicted to their phones. But going out on the streets and having the luxury of being an educator, the youth are active. They are doing things. They're the ones driving change. They're the ones challenging people, including myself, consistently to adopt new ways of thinking and alternatives. And I mean, at the same time, I'm saddened for what our country has produced in 2017 and the election of 2016. I'm also feeling pretty positive when I look at the youth. They're willing to take this guy on, and they were also willing to take on the Clinton corporate establishment as well. So I'm someone who's feeling rather confident about what I see, despite the dreary reality of 2017 thus far.
They're walking out across high schools and colleges at this moment, across the state, across the country.
All up and down the coast, the West Coast for sure, but across the nation, people as young as high school as well as college students are walking out and protesting what's happening to their country. And it's worth noting too, right, that Trump has a 37% approval rating, the lowest of an incoming president. And I believe the lowest of an outgoing president was 29%. Usually you come in with a lot of support. So this is weird that he's coming in almost at historically low levels for outgoing presidents like Herbert Hoover and George W. Bush. You have anything else for us, Desiree, on headlines?
Yeah, one other. Transgender healthcare falling short. Surprise, surprise. Ooh. So the Affordable Care Act, as we know, prohibited discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin, sex, etc. But because of the lack of specific language, transgenders are falling through the cracks and they're not being covered by anything. What's interesting about this article, too, is it also touches on the fact that these individuals who are in the healthcare fields are not being trained in any type of way to react or talk or even deal with a lot of transgender people. And also they spotlighted the fact that a lot of healthcare providers are just outright refusing to service a lot of the transgender people based off of morals or religion or whatever may be. So I thought that was unfortunate, but again, not really surprising.
Like you said, I mean, it's not a surprising headline. Again, you can access these at projectcensored.org, these stories that the corporate media doesn't cover. But this is one of the problems with this like monolithic way that corporate media covers oppressed communities, right? The idea was, oh, same-sex marriage, good. LGBTQ community is like fine now, right?
Yeah.
All problem solved. But these problems are way more depth and embedded in the society. These structures that come down on non-heterosexual practices in the U.S. So unfortunately, as you point out, this is not a story that really surprises me.
Another part that also stuck out was the mental health aspect. They said not only do 41% of trans people attempt suicide in their lifetime, over 40% experience clinical levels of depression and anxiety, which are not being treated.
Oh, at all?
Not at all. I mean, they're not trained to deal with this type of scenario. So transgender people are just falling through the cracks.
Now, who did the study? Remind us.
This originally came out through Women's E! News, but brought to us by Genesis and Andy Lee Roth at Citrus College.
All right. Andy Lee Roth, our associate director, producing another great VIN for us. Do you have anything else for headlines?
Last one. Sonoma County's female migrant agricultural workers unite to advocate for protections from abuse. Pretty self-explanatory. This has been going on in all the undocumented workers movements, but women are largely stepping up and stepping forward to advocate for their rights, as well as advocating against a lot of the verbal and sexual abuse that they are facing.
Thanks for headlines.
And that is the news that did not make the news.
All right, we'll be back after the break. Okay, welcome back to the Project Censored Show. This is your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host, Desiree McSwain, and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. And now we're going to do a segment on the show, the News Abuse and Junk Food News segment. And this week, we're going to talk about the coverage of California's storms. The great California storms captivated the state, they captivated the nation, they captivated the international community. And what sort of struck me, and feel free to chime in here, but CNN and Fox and others, they covered these historic floods and mudslides and the tree that fell up north that people used to drive their cars through. They covered all these stories, and I saw this as an issue of news abuse, first of all, because in covering this, they missed a real opportunity to be on the ground to discuss climate change, right? Instead, it was this sensationalization of how will California ever recover from the floods, even though the East Coast people completely laugh at us for that. But they really miss a chance to talk about climate change and how these extreme weather patterns are striking California. So there was a lot of talk about how California had suffered from this drought and, well, you know, the rains ameliorate the drought or not. And I think it was a missed opportunity to say, well, these are extreme weather patterns. This is the problem. We're probably going to end up with drought, flood, unless we do something to address issues of climate change. But there was really no talk about that I could find in the corporate press. And that was especially interesting since that same week during that coverage, a series of reports concluded, and they were published at livescience.com, that 2016 was the Earth's hottest year on record. So we have the hottest year on record, the report coming out in the midst of this extreme weather. And again, corporate media is more interested in showing falling down trees and discussing power outages and how people could possibly go to the grocery store when there's water on the ground. So I first wouldn't mind talking a little bit about that, sort of the sensationalization of this news abuse. I mean, what do you think is the cognitive dissonance here?
I think on the California end, I don't think there is a whole lot of cognitive dissonance. I think people here have been talking, our legislators are talking about it. California, as most people in the country and around the world know, is the most progressive and sort of a, I'd say, realistic state in terms of what needs to be done to address climate change. We're doing the most of anyone right here. So I don't think here in the state, maybe some of your corporate media, yes, they didn't. But a lot of people, I think, recognize and are talking about it, that this is, yeah, the new normal as a result of a wacky climate, and then we can expect these crazy droughts and floods. However, the amount of work being done and discussions for how to use this stormwater, I think people are actually getting engaged with the solutions side of climate preparedness and talking about, okay, if we're going to get floods like this, that's a positive part that came out of these last weeks. We need to address how are we going to save this water? How are we going to store it, capture it, use it in future times of drought? Because that's obviously what is coming.
I would agree that solutions angle is again something that's always missed from these stories as well, right? The potential great work people are doing on the ground. I even noticed like that the local media in California were covering like fallen down trees and power lines and stuff, which, you know, is like a sensationalistic image to stare at, but it doesn't give you a lot to sort of do like solutions for it, right?
It's a wild thing. With Trump coming in, you know, he's the ultimate entertainer, right? And Americans are addicted to entertainment and they've just elected entertainer-in-chief, but they've also been addicted always to weather stories, and that's always, you know, the weather news and the storms and the blizzards and floods, and obviously we've had our share with Hurricane Katrina and with Sandy in New York. Those are only clearly going to get more common, and it will be interesting to see how the media chooses, especially in an era when we might have actual climate deniers running our cabinets the way we did in the Bush years. Do people start to talk more? The New York Times headline was, at least it was loud and clear, that 2016 shattered records in 2015 and 2014. So aspects of the media are really getting on telling us what happened.
Another thing kind of unique about being in circles like in California, but elsewhere, we are long past in this state the awareness, right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't need people. The studies almost kind of bounce off me. It's like, yeah, I know. I'm interested in the solutions, but you are right. There is a large portion of this country where, you know, like no other Western country, by the way, that still does not buy the argument that humans have caused climate change. It took almost 30 years to get to the notion that climate change exists. Now we're at the point where we're still trying to convince about human activity, which makes a huge, huge influence in how you can even implement solutions on issues like this.
And, you know, the story was on NPR. It was all around about China. All of a sudden, people are talking about China investing, what was it, $350 billion now, so that by 2020, they will have, I don't know, 13 million new workers employed in the renewable energy industry. So it's clear that in this time of our dawdling and failure to recognize the climate realities, other countries, specifically the country that Trump has railed against in order to achieve his presidency, China are potentially going to do the most and become the leaders in solving some of these issues.
Yeah, it's sort of weird that China was always portrayed as like that bastion of communism is now using market-driven solutions to these things, right? Isn't that sort of odd? How that media narrative doesn't fit well with what China's doing there. I thought the story, though, covered the not only as a form of news abuse, I also thought it was a form of junk food news as well. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I am Nolan Higdon again. I'm in studio with my co-host, Ezra McSwain, and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. See, I also thought this was a junk food news story because in addition to, you know, being news abuse and that they missed this opportunity to make it a newsworthy story by talking about climate change and its impact, it also distracted from other news stories, in particular one in California. There was a story that came out in the midst of this great flood, again in quotes, about the epidemic of Oakland's child sex trafficking. And this is prominent throughout, the story goes on to talk about this, prominent throughout California and in particular the Bay Area. And there were some mentions of this previously, I remember during the Super Bowl, which is usually the city hosting the Super Bowl, sees dramatic spikes in human trafficking of sex workers or slaves. And during the same week of this great flood, they talked about this. And in particular, the article which came out of the East Bay Times, a local paper in the San Francisco Bay Area, they were talking about this film, Surviving International Boulevard. And the film documents the epidemic of Oakland's child sex trafficking. And I know this is a story that you look at, you know, people like us who read the independent press constantly, you're always seeing stories about the increase in human trafficking, not just within the United States, but around the world. But it doesn't get press attention. And it's so weird having this film being released. And on Inauguration Day, they played the documentary in downtown Oakland. There's not a lot of coverage of this issue. Why do you think that is? Especially with, we're like a media capital here in California, you know, with at least in the Los Angeles area. Why do you think it is that this issue gets swept under the rug?
I think there's definitely a few different reasons. First, I definitely want to say that if you live in the Bay Area and specifically in Oakland or just East Bay, you don't even need to read any articles. You can just drive down International or drive down East 14th and you see it. And you see the epidemic and you see it growing. But aside from that, you can also look to the scandal that OPD is in right now, Oakland Police Department, with sex trafficking or being involved with a sex worker who may have been underage around the time that she was involved with them, multiple officers. So this is something that I think is definitely mums the word because there's ties. There's ties to it, whether it's city officials or city police or anything like that. So definitely something that we are almost known for, which is, you know, not a good thing to say.
I would agree on that as well, that as much as it's tied, mum is the word, is because these people are in positions of power, the police officers, media, I also think the lack of economic influence of the people who are victims also plays a role as well, right? And again, this is an international problem across the country, but these victims don't really have advocates because they don't have lobbyists, they don't have people in Congress, and so they're not able to garner a lot of attention.
Does that mean we should be getting in touch with our Houston alternative media counterparts since that's where the Super Bowl is coming up? You think that's where these numbers spike? Look to Texas once more.
Yes, I imagine there'll be a lot of activists on the ground dealing with this issue. Every year there is, and in Santa Clara in particular, when the Super Bowl was there, there were activists as well. But yeah, it is a moment to think about with Super Bowl around the corner and these articles coming out about happening here in the United States, sex trafficking, these are the workers. In particular, too, I think that Desiree brings up a great point as well about the police department involvement as well. And there's been a lot of stories about that, not just here in California, but around the country, that police take part in these things as well. And that might be another reason why it's swept under the rug, because who's reporting it? And even if a victim does have the bravery or the context to be able to report such a thing, do they have an advocate, someone to believe them, a police officer they can trust in their lives?
I think what's sad, too, is once they kind of pass the threshold of being considered a child and they may be 18, 19 years old, and that may be one of their only means of living because that's all they've known, we dehumanize them. So we don't look at them as victims. We don't look at them as people who may need help because they may have immersed themselves around this kind of stuff. Not always the case, but sometimes that is the case. And so there's this conception that if you are a sex worker or a prostitute or anything like that, you can't be raped or you can't be assaulted or anything like that because your body is there for objectification. So I think that's also a big thing.
Yeah, I think you were talking about that earlier too with your headline. You're talking about the LGBTQI community and how individuals are not trained in healthcare to deal with the traumatic stress that individuals go through. I think this is an area, too, where individuals are not just sensitivity, first of all, trained, but also the realities of what it is to be a sex worker, or more accurately, a sex slave in the United States.
I think also just shining a light on prostitution in general, Vladimir Putin's comment, that evoked some chuckles, I think, when he said, well, no, of course Donald Trump coming to Russia wouldn't. Why would he need to hire prostitutes? He can, a guy like that who runs beauty pageants can get anyone. But of course we do have the best in the world in any case.
That was his international comment, bringing him many more supporters, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Around to get from that. Again, I think this is a perfect example of news abuse and junk food news. You have this weather story that they're covering here in California. Reporters are on the ground in California for the international community and national news. They completely miss this opportunity to discuss climate change, which is this issue that, again, activists are involved in. It's electrifying, which I think demonstrates, by the way you could build a political coalition. So that says that these politicians don't necessarily go after politically advantageous topics. Instead, they go with those, right? They want to sort of lead the public lead them. And then also just demonstrative junk food news as well, that if you're going to have reporters here and you're not going to cover climate change, there are other issues you could cover in California. And we hope in the coming weeks to do segments like this as well. I cover a series of other stories in the corporate media that distract from more newsworthy stories in the independent press. Anything else you guys want to say about our junk food news abuse segment this week?
It's definitely junk.
We'll be back after the musical break.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I am Nolan Higdon with my co-host Desiree McSwain and our senior correspondent Michael Levitin. And for the rest of today's show, we are going to interview individuals as part of the resistance to the Trump inauguration. Michael, I believe you've set up a series of interviews, so I'm going to go ahead and let you take this.
All right. First off, we got Jeremy Hale. This is a very interesting story. Jeremy Hale is a public interest lawyer in San Francisco. He works on solutions to homelessness. Prior to that, he worked as a federal advocacy counsel at the Sentencing Project, a nonprofit that works to reform the criminal justice system. More pertinent to this topic today, from 2008 to 2012, Jeremy worked with Democrat Lloyd Doggett, representing the 35th District of Texas in liberal Austin, that area. He was a legislative aide to Mr. Doggett. And in his time there in Washington, he saw the response to the early Obama years from the Tea Party. Jeremy, you're with us, and we'd like to talk to you about what this new project that you have going is.
Great. Thanks for having me.
What we're going to talk about today is a very interesting, very new solution-based campaign project. Don't know how you want to call it. Indivisible. It is a new group, and tell us what it is and how it came to be.
Well, after the election, several of us who had worked on Capitol Hill in Democratic offices were going through various stages of grief and trying to figure out how we could do something productive to respond to the election of Donald Trump, which we saw as really the gravest threat to progressive values that we had seen in our lifetimes. We were beginning to see a lot of activity on social media. Certainly there were marches here in San Francisco and elsewhere, but we wanted to find a way to channel that energy into a way that could really make a difference in Congress. And we didn't know much about organizing, but we did know how Congress works. We know how members of Congress respond to constituents. And based on our experience with the Tea Party in the early years of the Obama administration, we decided to write down some of our memories of the strategies and tactics that they used in order to stop the Obama agenda.
So you were there when the flood of Democrats came in 2008, and Obama was riding this enormous wave of progressive hope and change. And so essentially, all you staffers there and who were, you know, on the progressive side of things, you witnessed firsthand how the Tea Party, how they sort of marched out of nowhere and essentially overtook the narrative within a very short period. What were some of the strategies that now you're looking to, as you say, to progressives and to people across the country who are resisting Trump? What were some of those tactics they used that you're now recommending in this Indivisible guide?
Right. As you said, President Obama had won a decisive sweep of Congress. He seemed poised to enact a really bold progressive agenda. But we saw this other force taking shape, the Tea Party, that eventually brought policymaking in Washington and in Congress to a halt. And the two main lessons we learned from the Tea Party is that they stayed local and they were defensive. So what that means is they organized locally. The Tea Party focused on their own members of Congress and their own home states and districts. And by defense, what I mean is the Tea Party understood early on that if they tried to choose between competing conservative priorities, that they wouldn't be able to keep their coalition together. So instead of trying to put forward positive plans, they chose to just say no. And so the Tea Party was able to keep its movement strong and unified by standing in opposition.
Right. They were the Just Say No 8-year caucus that has now placed Trump in the presidency and Republican majorities in both houses. So what really is the idea then? You've got really progressives hamstrung and looking for a strategy and a way to kind of come out full throttle against the Trump regime. What would be some of the things that you're recommending? You lay out a whole lot of tactics. This is about a 25-page Indivisible guide. People can go to it at indivisibleguide.com and find out what specifically you're saying. What are some of the main things that you're recommending that that people across the country, red states, blue states, regardless of Congress people, what do you say people should now do?
Yeah, so our guide, as you mentioned, it's really based on a truth about how federal policy is made, and that's that Donald Trump's agenda does not depend entirely on Donald Trump. It depends on members of Congress agreeing to enact Donald Trump's agenda. And so what we learned on Capitol Hill is that those members of Congress respond to their constituents, because every one of them wants to get reelected. And the corollary is that members in other states and districts really don't care what you think. And so that means focusing local on your own members of Congress. And so that means that they want to look good in their home districts and states. They want good press. So when they show up to a ribbon cutting, they want the headline to be that they helped their district build a new bridge. What they don't want is coverage of a dozen angry constituents showing up and asking why they're cutting deals with a racist and corrupt administration. So showing up to public events, showing up to town halls, most members of Congress hold town halls to visit with their constituents. And then, you know, it's not rocket science, making calls to your members of Congress, organizing meetings and asking for meetings with your members of Congress to tell them to stand up against Donald Trump.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and our senior correspondent Michael Levitin, and we are interviewing Jeremy Hale. Jeremy, you spoke about a moment ago about these congresspeople being afraid of being connected to the racist narratives of Trump. I'm sort of curious. Racism definitely played a role in blockading the Barack Obama agenda. And you talked earlier about the Tea Party's success in blocking Obama's real high crest wave of support he had when he was coming into office. So how does your organization going to overcome some of the barriers that the racism in the United States place in acting a progressive agenda?
I mean, it's a very good question, and it's a tough question. We think in the short term, we are not going to be setting the agenda. We're only going to be responding to it, and that's at least for the next 2 years, which is why, in the short term at least, we're focused on defense. In the longer term, you're right that racism did play a role, I believe, in the opposition to President Obama and his agenda, and continues to play a role all across the country in terms of mass incarceration and the suppression of voting and those sorts of issues. But I guess we see right now a sort of extraordinary threat to the country in Donald Trump. And so our position is that, and the reason why we put this guide together, is that Donald Trump must be stopped. And, you know, one other thing going to tactics, part of what we've done with our website is set up a place where you can find other like-minded people and other groups who are organizing around the country, but also in your community. And so here in the Bay Area, there are several dozen organizations that have already organized, that are holding meetings, that have already met with their senators here and said that it is unacceptable to make deals with this administration.
Okay, and can you remind us of your website again?
It's www.indivisibleguide.com. We also have a Twitter page @indivisibleteam. On that website, really thousands of these indivisible groups have registered, have organized, and have already been successful. So one example, if you remember, on the very first day of the Congress, House Republicans moved to gut the Congressional Ethics Office. And indivisible activists in the home district of Congressman Goodlatte, who had sponsored that rule change, went to his office, met with his staffer there, put the encounter on social media, and got the news media to follow along and report on it. And within 24 hours, the Republicans had reversed their position on the ethics office. And so that's just one small example of how individuals organizing in resistance and, most importantly, publicizing it, getting video, putting it out on social media, getting the news media to cover it, can make a real difference in stopping the Trump agenda.
Don't you guys, Jeremy, don't you have like either a nationwide conference call or an organizing platform happening in the next day or two?
There are lots of actions happening all over the country. In Washington, there are indivisible groups meeting. Many of them are marching. You can sign up for our email list that will tell you about activities that are sort of nationwide activities to resist, whether it's Trump's cabinet nominations, whether it's the move in Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act. There is a lot of activity happening, and it's not all being, or very little of it is being sort of coordinated by us. What's really happening is that individuals out in the country, in communities, are starting their own indivisible groups and deciding for themselves the best way to take action in their home states and districts.
And I have a question, Jeremy. So a natural kind of question that arose from this group, for those of us out here in the Bay Area, or really in blue pockets around the country, whether those be university towns, whether they be across the East, obviously the whole West Coast, how can we empower ourselves when we already have congresspeople who basically support our progressive values? Here we have Barbara Lee in the Bay Area. We got Huffman up in the North Bay, really more or less in step with progressives out here. So how do we influence congresspeople if we're not in red conservative?
No, that's a great question. And you're right. There are a lot of great members of Congress, great progressive members of Congress. I believe Representative Lee was on, I heard her on the radio talking about resistance to Trump. But we do cover this in our guide. What do you do if your member of Congress is actually a good progressive? Sure, members of Congress respond to positive reinforcement. But also we'd say, look back at what the Tea Party did. The Tea Party didn't just focus on Democratic members of Congress. In fact, much of their activism was focused on Republicans. So stiffening the spines of progressive Democrats, emboldening them, making sure that they don't compromise with Trump. We need to keep relentless local pressure, even on progressive members of Congress, and remind them that cutting deals with this administration isn't bipartisanship, it's collusion.
Right. Excellent, Jeremy. Thank you so much. So once again, indivisibleguide.com. That's where you can go to get information, to join groups, to find out what's happening. And we'll end it right there, actually, on just this one quote from your guide. The best way to stand up for the progressive values and policies we cherish is to stand together, indivisible, to treat an attack on one as an attack on all. That is from your guide. Thank you very much for being with us, Jeremy.
Jeremy, thank you for coming on the show. We will be back after the musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and our senior correspondent Michael Levitin. Michael's going to continue. Now we've got interviews from folks on the ground as parts of these protests against the Trump inauguration. Michael, over to you.
All right. I believe we have Eleanor Goldfield on the line in the belly of the beast. Eleanor, you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. From Washington, D.C. Eleanor is an activist and journalist, makes film and music as well. She's the producer of Act Out, which airs every Wednesday on Occupy.com. Eleanor, what is happening on the streets in D.C. as we speak and before?
Well, I could go backwards. So right now, we're in a kind of feels like a war zone, a police state type war zone. There's been concussion grenades thrown, tear gas, pepper spray. The Black Bloc, they were throwing bricks, and there was a limo on fire at one point. There was also some trash cans on fire. And right now at the intersection of 14th and K, which is downtown, and if you're familiar with K Street, that's basically where all the lobbies are housed. And they've been pushing us back from 11th, 12th, 13th, and now we're at 14th and K. Earlier today, there were very successful blockades of the parade route and the parade to the inauguration was pretty much empty because there were so many successful blockades, each checkpoint having a theme. I helped organize the anti-war and Free Palestine block. There was Black Lives Matter, the climate block, feminism, LGBTQ, etc. And those started as early as 5:30 this morning. So it's been a very full day. And it kind of stepped up to the tear gas and pepper spray here, maybe like around 1 or 2 p.m. Eastern.
This is Desiree McSwain. Eleanor, can you tell us, have you seen any firsthand riot suppression, any arrests or anything like that that you can kind of speak more to?
I actually haven't seen any physical arrests. I have seen a couple of people thrown down to the ground, and I've heard that there have been people arrested, including an RT correspondent who was covering part of the Black Bloc movement earlier today. I personally have not seen any. At the blockades earlier today, the police were very hands-off. Obviously, now they're not. And, well, I take that back. Actually, at our anti-war blockade, the riot police showed up for no reason. We were holding a vigil to Free Palestine, and they started pushing people. And then they just all of a sudden backed off. So I don't know if that was kind of a training of some kind, but there weren't any arrests made there. But I assume there are some happening. There were some at the first Black Bloc movement that happened like around 1 or 2 p.m. And I'm assuming there are more happening right now. I just can't see it because I'm a bit removed from the action.
And you have a sense, Eleanor, that really the route was changed and that it's had an impact on the kind of spectacle that D.C. was otherwise expecting of the inauguration. I mean, things actually, it broke through with tear gas, clearly. What's the impact sort of on the city and how it's being viewed?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very powerful statement to have, you know, the capital of this country engulfed in the flames of car fires and tear gas. And, you know, it's something that people have seen all over the country in Ferguson and Baltimore and Los Angeles. But to have it sort of in the belly of the beast that has sort of been removed, if anybody's familiar with D.C., it's kind of like a cute southern town. And as far as I know, at least since I've been here, there haven't been any incidents like this. It's a pretty quiet town, and to have this happen, I think, is shocking for a lot of people, but I also think it brings home the frustration and the anger that is associated with not just Trump, but the neoliberal policies and ideologies that brought us to a Trump presidency.
Eleanor, this is Nolan Higdon. People were discussing the amazingly small numbers of individuals who attempted the official Trump inauguration. Can you describe sort of the size, that is the amount of protesters you've seen active on the streets in D.C.?
Yeah, I mean, there haven't been very many at all. We were situated, the anti-war block was at C and 2nd around there, and then the Black Lives Matter was on 4th, and the bikers for Trump were threatening to be in the thousands on 3rd, but I maybe saw 10 of them, and they just tried to walk through groups of protesters, you know, push their way through, and a lot of them didn't even make it through. I haven't seen that many Trump supporters, even at the checkpoints. So either they gave up or there just weren't that many to begin with.
Thank you, Eleanor. Great. We got to run to the next person. Really great. This is Eleanor Goldfield from Washington, D.C., Act Out producer on Occupy.com and activist journalist, auteur of all sorts. Thank you, Eleanor. Wonderful. And we will be moving over to our next person on the ground here, going to the other coast. Richard Becker, are you on the line here in San Francisco?
Yes, I am here.
All right. Hi. Hello, Richard. Well, we just got Eleanor Goldfield's take from D.C., tear gas and all the rest in the streets. What can you tell us about our drizzly gray Friday here on the Bay Area and how who came out, how many came out, and what the scene's like in San Francisco today?
Well, thousands of people have been taking part in demonstrations, which are continuing through the day and into the evening. And it's a very diverse group of people who have been coming out and very much, very heavily represented by young people, very spirited protests that are taking place. And there's really a very wide variety of people joining in. People have obviously taken off from work who work, and students have walked out from schools, high school students. And all in all, I think it really is the day of inaugurating resistance, which is what we in the Answer Coalition have been calling for. That we heard Trump earlier give this extremely chauvinistic speech, this America first and hell with everybody else speech.
Very nationalist, think, very patriotic. Yes,
right,
very
populist. Super patriot, yeah. And really, when you express that, you're really dismissing the rest of the people in the world. They don't mean anything. We should just think about ourselves here and, you know, no one else really matters. It's that same American exceptionalism that says, you know, the one indispensable nation, which makes all other nations and all other peoples dispensable, if you believe that, which of course we don't. But that's Trump. And then the other side is, I think from day one of the Trump administration, what we're seeing across the Bay Area and across the country are hundreds of thousands of people altogether who are out protesting. I know there's thousands of people in the streets in pouring rain in Los Angeles, as well as the people who are here in the intermittent rain in the Bay Area. So I think that's a cause of optimism. The only thing that's going to stop the Trump program is the mobilization of people. Not just one day, but it's going to take a protracted and determined and organized struggle to defeat this horrific program that the Trump administration represents, and today's a good start.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and our senior correspondent Michael Levitin. And we're talking to Richard Becker. Richard, you've been involved with protest movements, social movements for, seems like forever at this point. I'm wondering, you talked
seems
about...
Seems like that to me, too.
I'm wondering, you talked earlier about sort of the diversity of the individuals you're seeing. I'm wondering about the youth in particular. Have you noticed a change in seeing increasingly more and more youth involved in recent years, or would you say it's remained largely consistent?
No, it's definitely, there's definitely an increase in youth involvement. When I first became active, which is the late 60s, against Vietnam War and Black Liberation Civil Rights Movement, you know, overwhelmingly, the people were young. I mean, people didn't even think about the youth movement so much because, you know, that was the movement. And then over a period of time, that changed. And I think, you know, some of us who went back to that time woke up in the early 90s and realized we weren't youth anymore and that there hadn't been as many youth in the movement. But that's all changed now. And the day after the election, November 9th, we had a march here in San Francisco. It started out with about 3,000 people, and it went through several neighborhoods of the city. And by the end, it was 10 or 12,000 people, and it was overwhelmingly young people who joined that and who are joining in and who are organizing now. And so that, too, is a great cause for optimism. And the youth demographic, the young people, overwhelmingly rejected Trump and also overwhelmingly were for not Hillary Clinton so much as Sanders, who was talking in the name of socialism. And so I think those two are real causes for optimism and building the movement that we have to build now.
Richard, this is Desiree McSwain. I was just wondering, can you talk about the racial demographic of the people that you might see out there? I know that that's one of the big topics in a lot of segments is a lot of the racial tension and also a lot of the connotations around who voted for who and in what demographic. So can you talk about that?
Well, the largest number of people, the largest demonstration, I mean, that I've seen today was very, very diverse in its makeup. And there were not only the people who are speaking, but the people who are participating in the demonstration. And that, of course, is extremely important going forward. And, they're particularly people of color and young people of color, I think, feel very much under the gun as a result of the Trump administration, particularly those who are undocumented, are Muslims or other young people of color feel, you know, just, I think, like everybody, there was a shock that someone like Trump could become the president. And so, you know, the fight back that we build now has to be a unified one, a diverse one, where we're supporting all the different causes.
Absolutely. Thank you, Richard. Thank you. We're going to actually go. We got late momentary news just in from Washington, D.C., saying that from Eleanor Goldfield, in fact, that military Humvees and men in fatigues. So military wear has now hit the streets of Washington to challenge the protesters. Thank you, Richard, very much for the report from San Francisco.
Okay, you've been listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. Mickey and Peter will return in 2 weeks. Anthony Fest is our producer. Erica Bridgman is our engineer. The Project Censored show airs on close to 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work, please visit projectcensored.org and gcml.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook at Project Censored. We'll see you next time.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive force of slavery for almighty. Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers and our sisters.